If a person can do a thing, it is proof that others can as well. Now, that's an Abraham Lincoln quote, but what it says to me and every other franchise in Schooley Mitchell, if somebody can make $1 million, you can too. But what I learned as an accountant is that way too many people get into a business driven by their personal passion, and they don't consider that it's a good business model. Passion that I have is in growing a business that I can be proud of, that creates resources for me so I can enjoy my personal passions even more. We've got a basic saying here that if I can't make a nickel till I give you a dime. And so when we actually do have a win, it's kind of a celebratory thing because that client just built a bunch of resources they didn't have yesterday. So it is kind of enjoyable. The top 20% in any organization like ours, which is based on acquiring clients or any sales force, the top 20% kill it. You know, they make 80% of the money. That's really what his theorem was. Except what he didn't address was the bottom 20%. And it's such a surprise in a franchise. I don't think anybody that's a sales manager would be surprised at this, but the bottom 20% don't do anything. All businesses like ours, which are based on client acquisition, have this model, whether they admit it or not.
$650 million in savings. That's how much this franchise brand has delivered in documented savings for their clients to date. And in this episode, I sit down with Dennis Schooley, who founded the franchise called Schooley Mitchell over 25 years ago. What was most interesting to me is that although Dennis has been incredibly successful with over 200 franchisees in his brand, he admitted that this business wasn't his passion. He actually told me about the business he was passionate about and an interesting perspective around what you need to know about starting a business that you are passionate about. Now, I was really curious to understand how the top 10% of his franchisees are so successful. And what are they doing in thinking that the average performing franchisees are not? But overall, this is an opportunity for you to get inside the mind of a very successful entrepreneur so you can model his ideas and strategies. And so you can build the business you want, whether that's a franchise or not. Now, if you want to buy a franchise in the next 12 months, you should check out my free franchise masterclass at franchiseempire.com/masterclass. And if you want to work with me and my team on finding or buying a franchise or resale business, then you can go to franchiseempire.com/check territory and you can schedule a free call to see what's available in your area. The link is also in the description below. All right, with that said, sit back, relax, and enjoy the episode. Welcome to the Franchise Empire Show. They say Rome wasn't built in a day, and building your empire doesn't happen overnight. My name is Tarek Johnson, and owning franchises is what helped me go from employee to employer and start building my empire for my family. So this podcast is for you, the empire builders, for those of you who want to build something that stands the test of time. This is for those of you who are crazy enough to believe that you can make the dream in your head come to life. This podcast is all about bringing you real people who are building real empires so you can get inside their mind and heart and get proven strategies and actionable insights that will catapult you to build, grow, and scale your empire. All right, everyone, welcome to another episode of the Franchise Empire Show. I have here Dennis Schooley, who is the founder and CEO of, are you the CEO? What role do you play in the company, actually?
Well, I'm just the founder. And I mean, my wife and I actually run the business together. I do the franchising and the sales and marketing side. And Beth, my wife, is actually the smart one and the better looking one. But she runs the operations, the programmers, all the production, what we call the production, the analysis teams. So she's actually formally the president and I guess the CEO. We don't really bandy about our titles too much here, but I'm the founder.
Yeah, got it. So that's interesting to me because that seems to be the case with a lot of visionaries and founders. Are you familiar with EOS?
No.
The Entrepreneur Operating System?
No, I'm not.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So it's basically like an operating system in which to run a business on. And one of the two roles they talk about are visionary and the integrator, or other people call them operator, but it's how often the founders of companies don't actually run the day to day because that's not where they're best suited. So is that what you find in your business? And how long have you and your wife been in those roles?
About 25 years. So, and it's not quite as clearly cut as you say. I would suppose I'm the idea guy more so, but that's more on the development side, not just the franchise, but the sales and marketing development side for our franchisees too. That sort of falls on my table. But Beth, I would say, would be a visionary in terms of how to set up all the processes and all the new ideas. And right now we're implementing AI, for example, in some of our analysis processes. And so she's sort of leading that charge. So we're both active, and yet we're both idea people as well. So I think that's maybe a different scenario than the norm. And in terms of the EOS that you just mentioned, we actually have developed our own from scratch. So we actually have 9 full-time programmers on our team here. So everything that we use is our own code, and it's all proprietary.
Wow. That's pretty impressive. So tell us, let's take a step back for a second. Tell us about who you are and who Schooley Mitchell is, and what do you guys do?
Sure. And hopefully my personality doesn't belie this, but I'm actually a CPA. So, CPAs are generally a self-denigrating lot. But at any rate, I started out with Price Waterhouse when I was young, but I wanted to be on my own. And when I was 28, I went out and started my own accounting firm. But I've always been sort of a business development guy. So we got into more than just plain old accounting. We did management consulting and computer consulting and even sports consulting. And all those things sort of ended up in our own costs getting higher and higher. Now, we kind of knew because we were growing and doing more travel and things, but we didn't really have a good handle on it. So when we asked one of our programmers to write us something pretty rudimentary 25 years ago, just to have us look at our own telecom bills, because that's where we started, we found out that we were paying about 30% more than we should. And we thought, well, aren't we stupid? And then we went, wait a minute here. If we're stupid, probably our 700 accounting clients are stupid too, you know? So that's where it started. And really we started offering the service, trying to help our own clients reduce their costs. I became very familiar with franchising because one of our big computer clients was a very successful franchise system. And so I learned all about franchising, and it all kind of came together back in the late 1990s. And that's really where it started, from an accounting firm, which I don't do any of that anymore, thankfully. But that was the roots from which we grew.
Yeah, very interesting. So you guys specifically help businesses in cost reduction, right? And so tell us about how the business model works overall. How does the structure of that work?
Yeah. Okay. So what came out of that story I just told you was the fact that we were going to offer the services, and in the beginning it was only in telecom, to help our clients reduce their costs. And we weren't going to charge them any fees. So we do it on a contingency basis. We share the revenue from the savings that we generate from the clients. So that's now evolved to where we are now, where we look at 16 different cost categories. So basically what we're doing is we're looking at all those costs below the gross margin line in a financial statement, all those things that are causing death by 1,000 cuts to companies, things they really can't keep track of, or really don't have the wherewithal to do it because they're very complicated, even though they might seem simple. So we're looking at all of those, we're offering that service. And when I say we, our franchisees are doing this, offering that service to any business where they can come in and help them reduce their costs in, like I said, 16 different cost categories. And we don't charge fees to do our work. We just share in the savings 50-50 for a 3-year period with that client.
That is a fascinating business model. Very interesting.
It is unique, that's for sure. And really the message to the client is that you're not even paying us anything when we do share. It's the vendor that's paying us because you used to be paying them and now you're not.
That's a good, I see what you did there. Yeah.
We've been doing it for a while.
Yeah. That's clever. That's really interesting. So I'm curious what that was like. You said at age 28, you started your own firm. What was that? Did you leave your corporate job at that point in time to start your firm? And can you remember what that was like deciding I'm going to go out there and start my own business?
Yeah, it was nerve wracking. It was, I left Price Waterhouse, and that was a great company, you know, great people, great training, great company, but I wanted to be on my own. So I actually started not only a CPA firm, but a baseball school back then. I played serious baseball for a long time. So I started a baseball school and an accounting firm from scratch.
Interesting. So was the baseball school like your passion play in a sense? Like, hey, I'm really passionate about this. Let me see like what will work out of the two.
It was. And every one of those baseball clinics you see throughout the United States and Canada started from what I started back in the late 1970s, quite frankly. So they may not know it, but that's where it all started because there was nothing that existed like that at the time. Now, I didn't do that for a long, long time because other opportunities came up and we did that more on a helping communities level rather than a business level after that.
So our team have looked into a few hundred franchises and put together a list of 5 low-cost franchises that all make $1 million or more and that have a proven track record of both happy and profitable franchisees. So if you have a net worth of at least $150,000 and you want to see if the territory that you want is still available for any of these franchises, then you can go to franchiseempire.com/check territory. All right, let's get back to the episode. Yeah. Well, it's an interesting point, I think, because there are a lot of individuals and, you know, you guys have, how many franchisees do you guys have?
We have about 260 right now.
260. Okay, that's a good bit. So I'm sure overseeing the sales and marketing side of it, you hear all the time from people who may say, I really want to do something that I'm passionate about. I have a different perspective on that whole idea when it comes to starting a business, especially if you're still in the corporate world. But what's your perspective on that?
I absolutely do. I actually wrote an article about this very subject. And, you know, at the time with the baseball school, it was all about passion. But what I learned as an accountant is that way too many people get into a business driven by their personal passion and they don't consider that it's a good business model. Now, that wasn't the case with the baseball school. It actually was. But there's a lot of people that get into a business they really shouldn't be in because they are a good cook, so they get into a restaurant, or they dress well, so they get into a retail shop, or, you know, they like sports, so they get into a sports business. Well, that's no good if there's not a good business model, because now all of a sudden, not only do you not have a good business that's going to succeed, you kind of ruin your own passion. Because it goes down the drain because it doesn't work. So my article that I wrote, and I think it's based on what you're saying, is the passion that I have is in growing a business that I can be proud of, that creates resources for me so I can enjoy my personal passions even more. I think that's what should drive people. And, I am certainly not passionate about debits and credits when I was in the accounting world. I just wasn't. But I built a business to allow me to do the things that I'm doing now and enjoy the other things that I do on a personal level. I believe that's what should drive people. And they should look beyond their personal passions to the business model that's in front of them.
Yeah, that's such a great insight. I think you and I overall had the same overline perspective and thought behind it, because that's the same thing that I say. You mentioned that, well, if it doesn't work, it kind of kills your passion, right? And it's like something that you're passionate about, that you enjoy doing it for the love of it. Well, if all of a sudden it has to pay your bills and it's not working, all of this negative emotion gets tied to now that thing.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, work, if you talk to Major League Baseball players or National Hockey League players or NFL players, you'll find that the passion that drove them to get there is different than what they experience as they've been an experienced pro. That it's now a job. And it's funny, you know, when you hear people talk about that and you're a driven athletic person, but they talk about it as a job, it's because it is a job to them. You know, it's not to say that that passion is completely gone, but it affects you when you're working at it every single day, trying to create a future for yourself and your family versus enjoying it. So people make so many mistakes. And really, it's why we crafted our business the way we have, because there's so many business people that I've seen through my past that have gotten into the wrong business because they thought it was sexier. They saw the sign on the road and, you know, they just hated it after a few months even or a couple of years. Because, you know, imagine that doctor who owns a donut shop and the baker calls in drunk at 4 a.m. Well, guess who's baking donuts? The doctor. He doesn't want to bake donuts. You know, and you could extend that to a lot of different models. So in our case, business people are who we're looking for because we have a business. That was a lot of businesses, but you know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, for sure. It makes so much sense. And what the more that I've gone on in business and the more I've spent time with other entrepreneurs that have been more successful than me in the business world, I wonder if you found this to be true. Winning in business is actually very boring. and most entrepreneurs actually, ironically, they, a lot of what they do, they don't necessarily feel like or want to do it that day either, but they're just a professional. It's like professional athletes. People think that, you know, they may love showing up, going to practice every day, but they don't. They wake up and have days they don't want to go, but they're a professional, so they step up and do it anyways. And I think sometimes people coming, especially from the corporate world, going into entrepreneurship may think it's going to be all sunshine and rainbows. And a good part of it could be, but it's the day-to-day is pretty boring and mundane overall. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I suppose, you know, I'm thinking of our business, and when we help clients, you know, for any of our friends, we've got a basic saying here that if I can't make a nickel till I give you a dime. And so when we actually do have a win, it's kind of a celebratory thing because that client just built a bunch of resources they didn't have yesterday. So it is kind of enjoyable. Now, the day-to-day to get to that point where we present that finding to him, that's not a lot of fun. That's work. That's hard work. And it takes sweat and intelligence and all those things that go into getting to that result. So, yeah. But, you know, and I think back to what you just said. I played college hockey as well. And I can remember we would practice 4 or 5 times a week to have 2 games. We used to hate going to practice, but it was part of what we had to do. It was the commitment of going through the everyday stuff to get to the part that you really wanted, which was in that case was those games, or in our cases, to get those clients, those savings.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. And so tell us about like, what are your, I'm going to layer in a couple questions here. So in terms of numbers in your FTD, I like to ask about, okay, item 7, what does it look like to start up? Item 19, what are the overall sales that you guys show in there? And then to piggyback off of that, what sort of franchisees are you guys looking for or find that have the most success in your model?
Well, why don't we talk about the last one first? Because what we're looking for are business people. You know, we've got a list of must-haves. And if someone doesn't have some management or executive sales, marketing, or consulting experience, we really don't want to talk to them. Now, I'm not going to say other people couldn't be successful, because what it really takes to be successful in our business is comfort in talking to other business people. So as long as someone's comfortable talking to other business people, we can teach them everything they need to know, and we can support them and coach them. So that's not the problem. But generally, we're looking for business people. Now, our item 7, which you asked about, really, it's pretty simple. Our franchise fee is $68,000. There's hardly anything else. You know, I mean, there's $700 or $800 worth of letterheads and business cards and some marketing slicks that'll do you for your entire first year. That's about it. You know, people need a computer and a cell phone and a scanner printer, but pretty much everybody has those already. So there's really not much investment here for a business that can be very lucrative. And so now I'll get into item 19. I hope that was satisfactory for item 7, because there's not much there.
Yeah, perfect. So basically under 100 grand.
Under 70 grand, really. Yeah.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah. Now, I mean, they're going to have some things. They got to, you know, have lunches and join the Chamber of Commerce and things like that. But that's just ongoing costs. But in terms of investment, it's under 70 grand and they're all in. Now, item 19, and that's a kind of a unique story here. And when I say unique, all businesses like ours, which are based on client acquisition, have this model, whether they admit it or not. So most people are familiar with the Pareto rule, the 80-20 rule. I don't know if you are or not, but you know what that is, right?
Yep.
So, and I actually always say, I wish Pareto was still alive because I want to talk to him. I'm trying to make it the schoolie rule and it's not catching on. So anyway, he's long dead. But his basic posit was that the top 20% in any organization like ours, which is based on acquiring clients or any sales force, the top 20% kill it. You know, they make 80% of the money. That's really what his theorem was. Except what he didn't address was the bottom 20%. And it's such a surprise in a franchise. I don't think anybody that's a sales manager would be surprised at this, but the bottom 20% don't do anything. And that's a shock in a franchise where they make an investment, they go through training, they got the same opportunity. So in Schooley Mitchell, we've got people making $1 million a year net. We've also got people making nothing. And that's what the item 19, and that's because they don't get out of bed. That's the only reason, right? So the real model, and it was reflected in our item 19, which was your question, is 20, 60, 20. And what I mean by that, 20% kill it, make all kinds of money, change their lives. 60% are lifestyle driven. And what that means is they want to make 75 or 100 or 150 grand. That's where they stay. 60%, that's where they stay. And then 20% are dogs. And we wish it wasn't that way. And we've tried to help everyone in our system for 25 years, but it always looks the same. So that's probably a different answer than you've ever gotten before.
Hey, so if you want to figure out if you should buy a franchise and learn the fastest and easiest way to figuring out the best franchise to buy and everything you need to know about the process, then you'll want to go get access to our Franchise Buyers Academy. In our Franchise Buyers Academy, you'll get a behind-the-scenes look into specific franchises and exactly how much money they are making. You'll get simple formulas for finding money-making franchises and a blueprint on how to scale them into a franchise empire that can be sold for a lot of money later on. You'll be able to finally answer the question on, should I buy a franchise? Now you can get access at franchiseempire.com/FBA. Now let's get back to the episode. No, I think it's a real answer. And you and I align on a bunch of things, which is cool and interesting, because I think that is the one unspoken thing that when people are looking at item 19 or looking at a business opportunity, they go, oh, this person's making all this money, or this person's not. The question that I'm always the most curious about is, what's the difference? What is the difference between the person, not just what they're doing, but the way that they think? Because in my opinion, all external results start with your thinking first, right?
For sure.
And so it's like, well, what's these people's mindset? How do they show up in their, what's their day-to-day look like? What are they doing?
And that's all it is, by the way, in our world, is mindset. Because see, the things that affect most businesses don't affect us here at Schooley Mitchell. It is only affected by the franchisee. We have a great system, great tools, great people, great support. That's all there. There's no question about any of that. But the person that works a regular work week and continues to do that and doesn't stop doing it, they're going to be very, very wealthy. The person that gets discouraged because someone said no to them and crawls under their bed and stops doing what we do, they're not going to make any money, because nobody's going to call their house asking for cost reduction consulting. So that's it. That's the only test here. And you know, you said something, and it's really reflective. I've got a sign in my training room. It's one of my favorite quotes, and it says this: if a person can do a thing, it is proof that others can as well. Now, that's an Abraham Lincoln quote. But what it says to me and every other franchise in Schooley Mitchell, if somebody can make $1 million, you can too. You have to decide, and that's all mindset. And that's my most powerful word in my dictionary, is the word decide. Anybody that wants to decide to be successful in Schooley Mitchell will be. If they don't make that decision and they stay home, we wish we could help them, but we can't.
Yeah. Well, I think from a, because we have a lot of, you know, people that watch this that want to get into franchising or buy a franchise. We also have a lot of franchisees that watch this as well or listen. And so when I think about this topic, Dennis, I think about it, you know, you're thinking about it mostly from Schooley Mitchell, and you guys have proven that the business model works. 260 franchisees, you're probably in the top 1% of all franchise systems in the U.S., I would imagine, with that number of franchisees. And the question that I think a lot of franchise buyers will think about is, well, when is it the case that it's a flawed system or a flawed market or territory or location? How do you determine that? So I know that your perspective is with your franchise system, but you probably talk to a lot of different folks in the franchise industry. What's your perspective?
I do. And that's why I said what I just said, because all the things that affect most businesses, most franchises, they don't affect us here. Because, you know, you're right. I can get involved with a franchise, and if it's the wrong location or the wrong recipe or too many competitors run into the area or whatever, those the wrong buying group, you know, I can be affected by that. And that's not in my control. None of that happens in Schooley Mitchell. See, we don't have territories. So demographics don't affect us. So if it's a bad location, doesn't matter. I can get clients anywhere I want. So demographics has zero effect. Economic conditions has zero effect. You know, and I can't tell you how many businesses will tell me they're recession-proof. They're really not. Doesn't mean it's a bad business, but unless they're selling essential goods or services, they're not recession-proof, because disposable dollars disappear and there's just no money to buy what they sell. Well, with us, what do people have to do in a bad economic time? They got to cut costs. That's what we do, and we don't charge money to do it. So we're 100% elastic to economic conditions. And as far as competition goes, I'm not going to say there's nobody doing what we do. Most anybody that does anything similar is all going after those $100 million companies and up. We can certainly do that. We've worked with companies like Ford and Pepsi and Sony. But nobody's out there helping all those businesses in every community, the accounting firms, the dental clinics, the car dealers. So we've got a void market when it comes to competition. So I get your point, but in our case, nothing affects it except the person. Nothing.
Interesting. Now, so how does the business work? Or is it like what some of the business coaching franchises where it's based on mostly one person? Or do you have franchisees building large teams? What does that look like?
Some of each. I would say about 75 or 80% of our people do work on their own. And there is a leverage model built into our model because we do all the analysis at head office. So as long as a person acquires clients, they just keep putting them in the funnel so they can build as big as they want, even on their own. But we do have about 20, 25% of our people that they want to grow more. So they will hire another complementary business development person or more than one, usually on a subcontract basis. And I think the biggest franchise we have has 10 or 12 people, right down to one person.
Interesting. So with you guys doing the cost analysis, so when you say that you guys are analyzing the numbers, documents, invoices, et cetera, and then what creating a proposal and plan that the franchisees then go and present?
That's exactly right. Now, our analysts will present it along with them, so they're not on their own. So it's a group Schooley Mitchell presentation rather than just Joe Blow, which really provides oomph, you know, but that's exactly what happens. So our franchisees don't have to be experts in any of these cost categories. We teach them enough to be able to talk about it, know where the issues are, and convince the client that we should look. And then they present the reports, they build the relationships with the clients, they get referrals, they get renewals. That's what the franchisee's doing and presenting those reports, like you just said. But we're the ones tearing through bills and looking at contracts and being on hold for 3 hours. That's us. That's not the franchisee. And not me either, by the way. We got people.
Okay. Yeah. Wow, that's interesting. So the business model really is primarily business development from the franchisee's perspective. Like you just got to go out there and hunt and go get clients, essentially.
It is, although I don't want anyone to think it's just a sales job. It's more than that because there's a big exit strategy here too. We had one sell for $4.5 million just a couple of years ago. So each client has a value because it's got a future cash flow attached to it. So as you acquire clients, you're building an asset as well, and you're managing that asset. You're certainly managing ongoing relationships with your clients by presenting them reports and working with them for referrals and things like that. But yes, if you can't acquire clients, you're not going to be successful. But you know, it's very similar to an accounting firm or a law firm or a financial planning firm. And nobody thinks of those people as salespeople. And yet if they didn't get clients, they wouldn't have a business. You know, so it's very similar to that, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Same thing with doctors, right? Dentists. I mean, when they're saying, hey, you know, you need a root canal or you need to do this or that. I mean, if they don't influence you to say yes, I mean, even if it's ideally it's in the other person's best interest, right? To say yes. Ideally, that's the sales dynamic in a transaction. But they're also in essentially a sales role.
Well, frankly, I find dentists and chiropractors to be sales-oriented fully. You know, that's exactly what they do.
Yeah, I remember when my wife and I were living in California. So we had owned some juice and smoothie franchises, and there was a dentist across the street from our store. And I think they were one of the ones that were either owned by like a PE firm or some sort of group where they really have the model down. And so every time you went in, they would upsell you on this optional rinse. This you really need this rinse. And the rinse was, you know, it's like 40, 50 bucks for this rinse that took like 30 seconds. I'm sure their margin on it was probably insane. And
it's water and food coloring is what it is.
It really drove my wife crazy. She actually wound up leaving that dentist and finding another one because it She was like, guys, stop upselling me the rinse. I don't want the rinse. I didn't really care.
Well, you know, it is true. My own dentist is very honest and upfront, but you're right. I left another one because I felt they were selling me all the time. I'm not trying to denigrate dentists here, though. We've got some great dentists as clients, and most of them are very honest, but they do have to sell.
Yeah, but I think it brings it back to the point where there are a lot of very operational or kind of engineer type personalities that get into franchising or want to get into franchise. And I think one of the things that I didn't understand in my first 9 failed businesses prior to a franchise was how much as an entrepreneur, your role is 80% sales and marketing, because it doesn't matter how good the product is. If you can't get customers, none of it matters. You have to master that area. Is that part of why that's the role that you play, or do you find that that's also your natural skill set and ability?
Well, I guess it developed over time. I mean, originally I was doing debits and credits, but I certainly turned into a business development person because I started to enjoy that, the client acquisition side, the relationship side, presenting to them to show the results side. I wasn't so keen on doing the nuts and bolts. So that's sort of how that's all developed. And, I read a lot and learn. I continue to learn every day, and I just try to pass that on to our franchisees to keep improving our methodologies, and Beth does the same on her side of the business as well.
Yeah. So going back into the franchisee success, from a deeper level, what do you see is the difference between those franchisees that are really successful, the folks that are in that top 20%? Can you kind of just describe that persona, their characteristics, how they're wired, and how they operate?
Yeah, it really is only the desire to build something great and to work 35 or 40 hours a week doing it and not let anything get out of your way. Now, it doesn't mean they don't have some freedom with time. They absolutely do in our business. But generally, those people that are making hundreds of thousands or even in the millions, they're simply working their 35 or 40 hours a week with no dust on them. You know, they work kind of 8 to 5, and there's nothing that they want to do except do the things that Schooley Mitchell franchisees do: get clients, build relationships, you know, have lunch and have coffee with people, building more relationships, presenting reports. That's it. There's no trick. It's just what's in their heart and mind. And that's the only difference between that guy that makes $1 million a year and the guy that makes zero. There's nothing else.
And what do you say to the person that's doing all the right things externally, but still not seeing the results?
Well, that actually won't be the case. I mean, are there some people that need to be sort of coached with better messaging, handling of objections, that kind of thing? Sure, but that's a learnable skill. And we assign a coach to every franchise when they come out of training. So they get that each and every day that they want to have that. So the only reason that someone isn't getting clients is because they're not talking to people, that's it, or they're refusing the coaching help. But really, we know our close ratio. We know it's 30% actually is what our close ratio is, based on a survey we did with all of our franchisees. And so we know that tells a franchisee, if I talk to 10 people this month, I'm going to get 3 clients if I perform on average. So I just got to talk to 10 people. If I want to talk to 20, then I'm going to get 6 clients. It's a linear ratio, but if I only talk to one, then it's going to be 1 client every 6 months, and that's no good. That's it. There's nothing else. So anybody that's doing everything we train them to do, they are getting clients.
Yeah, interesting. What's the role of the franchisee versus the role of a franchisor, generally speaking? Maybe not just, Schooley Mitchell, but what onus outside of just going in and doing the work is on the, franchisee, where it's like, hey, this is not the role of the franchisor to provide you with X?
Yeah, I mean, the franchisor, let me start there. And I will make sort of an aggressive comment here. I would suggest to you there's lots of people that are a franchisor that shouldn't be, because they don't really have a secret sauce. They don't really have a system that is a differentiator for the people that are going to operate it, the franchisees out in the field. And I think that's not right. So when we first started, we knew we had a unique offering. But we had to develop systems to make our marketing and our sales and our tools and our programs and our support all unique and really build that system so it was of full value to that franchisee, because that's what they're investing in. You know, you pay a franchise fee to become a part of a developed system. And so that's what the franchisor's responsibility is, to develop that system that, I mean, it's never going to be completely fail-safe, but as foolproof as you can make it. And you just need to have good operators. So the franchisee, on the other hand, should be making a commitment to, I want to do this because I want to do what they do, right? If someone joins a franchise system and wants to do it their own way because they were so successful in something else that they did in the past, that's a huge mistake. So if you're going to join a system, it should be a replicable system. That's the franchisor's responsibility. But if it is replicable, then you need to replicate it. And that's really where, and if you do, like I said before, if somebody succeeds, then everybody can succeed. That's the proof in the pudding. It's not driven by location or anything else. It's not in your control. I guess I went back to Schooley Mitchell there a little bit rather than in general. I didn't mean to do that. But, you know, in general, the franchisor's got to develop a system that is unique, has some secret sauce in it. And the franchisee's got to know they're putting the heat to the recipe. They've got to replicate what's being done in the successful locations of that franchise system. And if they do, they're generally going to be successful.
Yeah, it's a really good point. It's interesting how some of these franchisors there's a lot of emerging franchisors out there that are really getting a lot of just being quite aggressive, you know, in their franchise development and, you know, bringing people on quite rapidly. For me, from my perspective, it makes me a little bit nervous to see how fast some of these franchisors are growing without the track record to tail. And then, you know, some of them are getting started based off of, acquiring an existing business and franchising it. And I don't know that people will quite duplicate those same results.
I think there's some risks to what is happening in franchising right now. And it's reflected in the, you know, what Congress is doing or what some state governments are doing and trying to regulate things that they shouldn't be regulating. But the cause is because there are some bad actors out there and there's some bad effects. You know, one thing is what we're saying. There's people going into franchising that shouldn't be in franchising, and therefore that's going to create some failures. And that's not going to be good because that's going to make legislators want to legislate more. I believe in some cases credit should not be extended to people that it's extended to, and therefore they get credit and they get into a system where they're not really the best operator or should have that credit. I think that's a risk. And I think there are selling organizations out there, and they could be individual franchises, they could be FSOs. I don't know. Some of them are good, some of them are not. But I think some are overselling. And a franchise should never be sold. It should be granted. It should be a good match between two entities, the franchisor and the franchisee. And if it's a good match and everything else lines up, that's what it should be. I think those three things I just mentioned, though, are a risk to our world of franchising.
Yeah. I'm seeing that as well. And I think it's risky and they are being oversold a good amount. I see sometimes. Now for someone out there, for franchise buyers specifically, that, you know, there's a group of people that they're successful, you know, let's say they make over six figures a year. Maybe they're the either the primary or the sole income earner in their family. You know, they have kids, but they really want to be an entrepreneur. And the idea of starting from zero, you know, or taking a step back financially, you know, either they're not in a position to do it, you know, or it makes them really nervous. What do you say to that person?
Well, it's funny you ask that, because about a year ago, we actually started a model called the Builder Franchise, which is created for that type of a person. Now, they still need to be a professional person, but it's really for somebody that can't leave their job, you know, because you're right. They need the income. They need the health insurance. Their spouse won't let them. For whatever reason, they need to keep that job, but they would sure love to build a professional business like ours. Well, we have this Builder Franchise where as long as they've got 5 or 10 hours available during business hours, because this is a business to business business, then we would allow them to join our system. And it's basically the same model, a few little changes on the financial end, but not a whole lot. So we actually have the capability for that person to start a business. They're just going to start more slowly because they're not spending as much time. They're going to build it up to get to that point where they can say, okay, now I can pull the trigger and go full-time, or they can stay part-time. So we actually have a solution for that. I think that's what you're asking anyway.
Very interesting. So your traditional model is, hey, this is a full-time role. You need to go in full-time, dedicate yourself.
Yeah.
How long in that model, you know, if people are on average, how long does it take for someone to really build, to gain traction and kind of start, you know, generating the necessary revenue to support themselves?
Yeah. And I mean, there is a ramp up. It's like when I left Pricewaterhouse, I was 28 years old and, you know, I didn't have any clients and I certainly wasn't going to take Pricewaterhouse as clients. So I had to start from scratch. And that's really what our franchise is. Although every business out there needs what we do at Schooley Mitchell, you know, I had to find a client, had to do the work, had to bill it, had to collect it. So there's a period of time where that has to happen before you start to earn cash flow. Now, one of the things that I say to all of our new franchisees in training is that I want them to get a client their very first week after training. And most of them do. It might be a small client to start things with, but that becomes a referral source and learning and everything else. But there's no reason someone can't go out and start getting a client every week. And if they do that after their first 4 or 5 months, then all of a sudden, every one of those clients, those annuities start coming into the door and into their bank account. So it's all about getting that started in the right way to have that result starting a little bit later. What we say to people to be very safe is if you've got enough for the franchise fee and to pay your personal expenses for 12 months, that's more than you should need unless you're going to sit in your thumb, right? Because money should start coming in month 5 or 6. So you're not going to need all that, but to be safe, get that.
Yeah. Cool. Interesting. Reminds me of back in the day, my career started out in financial advising. So I had my investment licenses for 15 years. And that it reminds me of building a book of business. You build a book of business with some with recurring revenue and, you know, you just had to go out and keep getting clients.
Well, and that's why I said it's very similar to an accounting firm, a law firm, or a financial planning firm. It's a professional business advising businesses, not dealing with tax or law, but very similar in the nature of those businesses have to acquire clients.
Yeah. Cool. Awesome. So my last question is, you know, the name of this show is the Franchise Empire Show. When you hear that term, a franchise empire, what does that mean to you?
Well, I'm going to address that based on a franchisee's perspective, you know, who has been in corporate America. It does provide them with the ability to build an empire, whether that's, you know, on their own or whatever model they're going to join. It does give them the ability to do things they could never do in a job. You know, you can't build an empire in a job unless you're going to end up being the sole shareholder in the business you're working for, you know, but in a franchise, you've got that capability. You just got to make the right choice to make sure it suits your skill set and that you're willing to do what needs to be done. But to me, it allows individual people to build an empire. And I think that's a cool motive for people that are looking to start out.
Yeah, me too. Awesome. Well, Dennis, thanks so much for coming on the podcast and sharing your nuggets, your wisdom, and telling us about the business that you built. And congratulations. I mean, just wow, how incredible over 25 years to build what you built and have over 200 franchisees, and I'm sure changed many lives. I would imagine that probably feels pretty satisfying when you put your head on the pillow at the end of the night.
Well, Beth and I talk about that all the time, quite frankly. You know, we're proud of what we've built. We've got 130 people working in our head office here supporting our franchisees. So we're providing livelihoods for them. We're providing the ability for 260 people and growing to change their lives if they want to do that. So we're kind of proud. You know, it came from dust, from an idea, 25 years ago that we've built into this. So we are proud of it. And I thank you for that comment.
Absolutely. All right, Dennis, have a good one.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Hey, before we go, thank you so much for listening to this episode. I put my heart and soul into providing you value through this podcast to help you build your empire. So please subscribe if you haven't already. And the biggest thank you could ever give me is to drop a review, because more reviews equal this podcast getting more listens, which means we can share this message with more people and hopefully positively inspire them like we have you.
You can also share it with someone you care about that you believe may benefit from listening. Thank you, and until next time, go build your empire.